Alrighty, welcome to Discovery 1, Module 9. And this lecture today is brought to you by Grace, who will be delivering the lecture with me, answering any sticky questions that might come up. And I'll hand it over to her. It's all yours.
Okay, welcome to Discovery 1, Module 9. This chapter is on troubleshooting networks. The actual skills are much the same as the ones we talked about in ITE1, but we will be talking about routers, access points, and cables rather than individual workstations. People rely on their networks 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So when a network goes down, it's important to get it back up as soon as possible so that people can get on with whatever they need to do. I was unable to connect to the internet for a couple of days, and I both work and go to school online, so this was a big problem. My life pretty much stopped, and when I got back online, I had to work on catching up on all the work I needed to do, and I lost a couple of money-making opportunities, so that wasn't very good. Okay.
It's all right. We quash all the pauses out of the middle, so don't panic if you stop, because the gap removal is going to take all those gaps out. There we go. And Ian's going to have a listen as well. No pressure. Okay.
Perfect. Okay. All right. Well, I'll just go on. Okay. Troubleshooting is the process of identifying, locating, and correcting problems that occur. Experienced techs often use instinct to troubleshoot, but there are structured ways of doing it as well. Three popular methods of troubleshooting are bottom-up, top-down, and divide-and-conquer. Okay, so let's go over quickly the seven layers of the OSI model. We're going to list them from bottom up. It's physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, and application. If you need a review on the layers, refer to Discovery 1, Module 5, because we have a lot to cover today. So when using up a bottom up approach to troubleshoot, start from the physical layer, checking things such as, are the cables properly connected to all devices? What is the status of the LED lights, if you can see them? If the entire layer is fine, then you go up the OSI model until you find the problem and you solve it. The top-down approach is the exact opposite. You start at the top from the application layer, checking things like if the internet browser or email applications are working, and how many computers the problem affects, and you're going to go down all the way to the physical layer if the problem you can't find the problem. So the final one is divide and conquer. You're going to start somewhere in the middle, for example, the network layer, checking TCP/IP, and that's usually what I do, because then I'm able to determine whether I have a problem in the top half of the OSI model or the bottom half of the OSI model. Many technicians bypass these methods and use trial and error or substituting a known good component. But if you don't have very much experience or you really don't have any clue what the problem is, these methods give you a good start. Now, before I go on, are there any questions? Go for it.
I'm just going to point out that you've made a comment there whether you can see LEDs, which is a valid point. I did get my hands on a little light probe the other day that has two modes, one for detecting lights in a room and one for detecting print on paper. And it can actually detect whether LEDs are on or not. So that is a workable solution for us. And I was also going to point out very briefly that technicians that tend to use trial and error and make a botch of it tend to get their users quite upset. You wouldn't feel very confident if a technician was using trial and error and not getting anywhere if you were talking to someone on a help desk. You'd certainly get the feeling that they didn't perhaps know what they were doing as well as you'd like them to.
Yeah, that's probably why you don't use it unless you really have a good idea. Okay, yeah, I cut out, sorry. I was saying that that's why you probably wouldn't use it unless you had a pretty good idea of what the problem might be and could narrow it down to a couple of solutions. Okay, so no other questions?
Everyone happy with speed of delivery and stuff? I was just checking everybody's cool, everybody's picking up Grace okay, all audible, everyone happy?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Okay, cool.
If anyone is not happy with it and needs me to slow down or speed up, let me know and I won't be... Okay.
Probably, but perhaps you're dropping somehow. Anyways, yeah.
No, it's just a sensitivity on the ends of a phrase per tape, and in the actual lecture it's not a problem. It's just if she brings her voice down at the end of a phrase, the microphone will tend to cut out. That's not actually happening in the lecture.
Okay, I'll try not to do that. Okay, moving on. When troubleshooting, it is very important to keep good documentation. Make sure to document the problem encountered, steps that you took that did not work, and steps that led you to the resolution of the problem. It's important to document the steps that did not work, because if you don't, then you won't know what didn't work. And if you're ever looking back, if this problem ever happens some other time in your technical life, you'll have to go over them all again. If you write down the steps that don't work, you'll be able to look and be like, oh, this didn't work, this didn't work, this didn't work last time, so I can bypass them, save myself some time, and fix the problem much quicker, and look really good. So it's important to document these things to the best of your ability, because then you have really good notes to go back on in later experiences. Also, you do have an instant record of what didn't work. Now we're going to talk about the troubleshooting process. The first thing you do is verify the problem and determine how bad it actually is. Sometimes users will overhype a problem or underhype a problem, or it could just be user error and there really isn't a problem. So we have to figure out what the problem is first and really how bad it is before we start to solve it or do anything else.
I was just going to make a comment there and say often you get a call from a user and their complete diagnosis of the problem is my computer doesn't work. And that is probably the most unhelpful statement you can ever be given on a help desk. And it's your job as a support tech to figure out exactly what does and what doesn't work and exactly what the user means by my computer doesn't work. And we try to discourage users from saying my computer doesn't work because that isn't very specific, unless of course their computer really doesn't power up at all, and then they could probably be get away with saying that.
Right. Well, in this case, the least helpful statement would probably be the internet doesn't work. Well, that's nice, but what part of it? Okay, so here's how we answer that question when the user calls and says, the internet doesn't work. The next step is to gather information. Talk to the people that reported the problem, as well as other affected users. Ask questions such as, what error messages did you receive, if any? Have any changes been made to the workstations involved recently, or any other routers or equipment, if they know about that? Can you tell me what the symptoms are of the problem from your perspective? Now, can anyone else think of any good questions to ask?
Is it? There you go. So somebody who hadn't plugged their computer into the PowerPoint. That's certainly a good one. I'm just trying to think of other things. I think the other thing you'd have to find out too is often a certain amount of time is initially spent calming your user down, so that you can get sensible information. Now, did you work help desk for Hotkey at one point, Elise? I'm trying to remember.
Yes, I did, and I also did help desk for Hewlett Packard, and I did help desk for Premier and Cabinet, which is government. So yes, I've seen it all. Many different my computers don't work, and many different people in all sorts of states of depression and stress because they had to get briefing notes out to the Premier and all that sort of stuff on time, and they were scared that they couldn't because their computer didn't work, quote unquote.
Yeah, even in the help desk, some stupid things also take place. I remember, like, one person was asking me, my BIOS are not working, and then I figured out that she had not connected her keyboard.
That'll do it.
Yeah, it's a physical layer, all right.
He was trying to do all that with mouse, and certainly it's not possible, yeah.
Some BIOSes are actually GUI, but the majority do want a keyboard. And I think one of the things you'll find is that as you work as a help desk operator, and when we will get back to you in a second, Grace, I know you've got a lot more notes there, but you'll find that when you work for the help desk, when things break, they become your problem. And then when they get fixed, they stop being your problem. So it's a pretty thankless job, really. I mean, you basically spend all day fixing users' problems, and you get every iota of stress, frustration, anger, annoyance from the user population whilst you do your best to fix their problems. So you certainly have to have a very strong character, and you need to sort of really be very happy within yourself, because you are often dealing with a lot of very frustrated, tired, upset, unhappy users who are, quote, just trying to get their job done, unquote, and they've decided to make their problem your problem, perceptibly speaking, or at least until you resolve whatever that problem is.
Yeah, I've got some really good stories from when I was actually volunteering at the MoveOn.org help desk. Some people didn't know how to use email or printers, and we had all sorts of crazy...
Okay, I think it's back. Anybody? Ah, so Alex worked on boats, trying to fit stuff on boats and stuff. That would have been quite interesting. It's certainly character building stuff, the old help desk. I worked on the TAFE help desk for 6 weeks once, and I stopped working on the TAFE help desk because I was too honest with the clients. They liked me, yes. But my boss didn't like me very much.
The bosses don't like you. Yes, I've been there too, Kerry.
Well, yeah, I rang radio. This person rang me up and said, I'm having a problem with such and such. And I said, look, I'll get back to you in 5 minutes when I've got an answer about that. And I hung up the phone, and my boss said, you can't tell her that. I said, well, I just have. And he said, you're going to reduce the quality of this help desk. So I rang this person back and said, do you have a problem with the fact that I'm getting back to you in 5 minutes? She said, no, at least you tell me when you're getting back to me. And I got back to her in 5 minutes, and it was all good. But often the bosses don't see it that way. But the other problem is a lot of help desks run on call volume. You are encouraged to get through as many calls as possible. And I wouldn't be surprised that if a lot of the... A lot of the help desks and stuff do run on call volume and number of cases and problems solved. It's not the best benchmark for a help desk.
Oh, look, I remember getting into trouble because I spent too long on the call to one client in particular. It didn't seem to matter that I was doing some rapport building and making that person comfortable with me, so if they rang me up with a similar problem tomorrow or the next day, that they know that they would get it resolved. So, no, that doesn't seem to matter sometimes. So, there's a lot of people running help desks shouldn't be running help desks.
Okay.
So, next, we have to gather information about the affected devices. Get the model number of the device. Then, we're going to go online and look up as much information about the device as you can find. If there's a manual, download it. Make sure to get any recent logs if the device provides them. Usually they'll be in the GUI or on the website if the device has a web interface. Find out what software and or firmware the device is running to check for compatibility problems. One of the most common types of network problems is a physical problem. Physical problems only concern hardware such as routers, NICs, and cables, no software. But that's pretty obvious, right? Use your senses to detect problems such as touch, smell, hearing, sight, if you have it. Examples include a cable that came unplugged, reach down, feel, is it unplugged? If it is, plug it back in, you're good. Or a router that you can smell the smoke coming out of. If you have that problem, you're in serious trouble and your router's done. I had a problem a few weeks back. I thought my internet had gone down, and I was... probably about an hour, I went and eat dinner. I come back, oh, the internet's still not up. So I tried to ping the router, and no ping. So I realized that while I was, just being mad at the internet service provider for my internet being down, it was my fault. And I had actually accidentally unplugged the cable and not realized it for an hour. It was pretty good.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, there are quite a number of people who ring up the help desk convinced that their internet service provider is at fault. And then when the poor hapless tech on the help desk tracks it back to their cable, they tend to bail on the call pretty quickly and feel a bit small. So that certainly can be. Luckily, you didn't get to the point of calling the help desk, so it's all good. The other thing that can happen, of course, as one of our students pointed out last year, is the pet rabbit can sometimes eat through your network cables. So that's a good one to check as well, especially if you have a pet rabbit.
Oh, I had this cat that loved to do that. It was horrible. All my cords were chewed up, and they ate a pair of noise-canceling headphones worth like $60. It was awful.
Yes, and it's not my just... dog likes to if she can chew through electricity cords, but I've managed to get them out of the way.
Ho, ho, ho.
Should have been.
apparently Scott's dog chews through cables, or could chew through cables. Does it still chew through cables?
No, it's migrated from that now to taking people's shoes when they leave them at the front door, which is highly amusing when people come back to put them on.
Hmm, okay. Yes, that would be. I thought they're not supposed to do that, guide dogs. They're supposed to be well-behaved, but I assume yours is just getting there.
Yeah, she's still young. I'll give her a few more months.
Fair enough.
Just while we're on the topic of Layer 1 stuff here, I often tell the story when I was working at Premier and Cabinet how these technicians, they were above help desk, they were much, much more experienced than the help desk people, sat there for an hour trying to connect their dial-up modem. It was back in the dial-up days and they needed some modem access to somewhere. And they fiddled around for about an hour through dialogue box after dialogue box after dialogue box in the Windows modem settings. And I said, well, can you hear the modem dialing? Oh, no, that's not the problem. That's not the problem. I said, can you hear a dial tone? No, definitely wasn't the problem. I was wrong. Sure enough, they had it plugged into the network cable rather than the telephone cable, so they were not going to get a dial tone, ever. Took them an hour to fiddle it out. To figure that one out took me 2 seconds because I used my sense of hearing.
We had a similar, just another quick story, we had a similar one. Friend of mine worked for Osborne, and he said to the technician, he went to power up one of the computers and he put his ear down close to the case to listen to whether it was coming up, and the bloke said, what are you doing? And Andrew said, I'm listening to see if the hard disk powers up. He says, what are you doing that for? He said, oh, that's what my blind friend told me that taught me how to do tech stuff. And this bloke said, oh, blind guy? He wouldn't know anything about fixing computers, would he? And Andrew's like, yeah, taught me everything I know. And the hard disk in this one's dead. Apparently about 2 hours later, Andrew caught the tech with his ear down against the case, listening to see whether the hard disk powered up or not.
That's great.
Yeah, unbelievable. It's amazing what sighted people miss, because this is another very, very quick one. I had a friend...
Tech, or had he taught everybody?
This was the same tech that had done... But yeah, apparently they're all doing it after that.
Yeah.
Well, these friends of mine were just having trouble with their computer that was just about to go out of warranty, rebooting, just all of a sudden rebooting, all by itself, after it had been switched on for a little while. And this went on for months, weeks, and they took it back to the shop, and the shop said, no, nothing wrong with the computer, and the computer came back home. I rested my hand on the back of it and felt a very, very roasted hot power supply with no spinning fan. Problem fixed.
Did you just replace the supply, or did you do the Mr. Taylor TM trick of blue tack and oil?
I took the computer and introduced them to Mr. Taylor and let him do the trick with the oil. And that power supply and computer now belongs to Yvonne up in Darwin and still works.
We'll talk about blue tack and oil at the end of lecture if we have time.
Oh, good.
I was just going to say, I'm curious about that.
Yes, we'll do that at the end of the lecture. But the problem was that the little man in the Chinese computer shop couldn't pick it up. But it was very, very simple tactile discovery of hot power supply, thermal overload, computer shutting down.
All right, shall we go on? All right, now we're going to discuss software utilities that can be used when trouble. These are available in most operating systems, I'd say all of them, but I don't really know, including Windows. There are 5 utilities we're going to discuss. Each can be run from the command line in Windows by going to run and typing cmd.exe to get to your command prompt. Okay, so the first one we're going to do is ipconfig, which answers the question, do I have the right IP address and subnet mask? To see information about your computer's IP address, subnet mask, and default gateway, as well as many other useful things, type in ipconfig.com/all. To release your IP address information, this releases it back to the DHCP server. You're going to type in ipconfig.com/release. And you're not going to be able to do anything on your network until you renew your IP address and all of your IP information by typing ipconfig.com/renew. And this process has saved me from being without internet more times than I can count. I'll talk about one of those times a little later on in the lecture, and it's pretty hilarious. But does anyone have any questions on ipconfig?
I was just going to point out that the same, those methods are perfectly valid, and if you're a techie, opening up the command prompt certainly is a good way of impressing people. You can also do the same things by double-clicking on the network adapter and going to the support tab. There's actually a little troubleshooty wizard thing, so if you're taking somebody through who isn't particularly good at typing on the keyboard remotely, it sometimes pays to take them into the network settings and then double-click the network connection and go to the support tab. And there's actually a little troubleshooting wizard there that will go through and do all the release, renew and stuff automatically for them. Sometimes that's easier for people, especially if they're more graphically minded people.
Yeah, or you can just, I think you can right click on the network connection and you can press repair or diagnose and repair, and it should run through it and release and renew the IP.
I'll check that just out of morbid curiosity, but continue while I'm doing
that. It's if you click on your local area network or your wireless, if you do your applications key on it, it should show you a repair option and run you quickly through
status,
flushing the
repair bridge. Yep.
But sometimes I figure rather than digging that up, I can just go do it quicker, especially in Vista, by just typing in the command line stuff. Okay. The next utility that we're going to talk about is the ping utility. It answers the question, can I send an IP packet to another host? To use this, you're going to type in, from the command prompt, of course, ping, the host name or IP address of the server or machine you want to ping. When a ping is sent to an IP address, a packet known as an echo request is sent across the network to the IP address specified. If the destination host receives the echo request, it responds with a packet known as an echo reply. If the source receives the echo reply, connectivity is verified and it says that your packets were received, and it tells you how many milliseconds it took and all of that good stuff. If a ping is sent to a name, such as www.cisco.com, a packet is first sent to a DNS server to resolve the name to an IP address. Once the IP address is obtained, the echo request is forwarded to the IP address and the process proceeds. If a ping to the IP address succeeds but a ping to the name does not, there is most likely a problem with the DNS. Any questions on ping?
I was going to make a comment briefly. There is actually an interesting situation, which we'll talk about in Discovery 2, where you can ping hosts and SSH works, but www doesn't. And that's actually a problem with your MTU and PathMTU discovery. The ICMP please fragment messages aren't getting back to the host. So basically, if you SSH or telnet into a host or you ping a host with 64-byte packets, it will work beautifully. But if you ping it with big packets, it will go down in a screaming heap. So that's PathMTU discovery problems, and we experience them on ADSL. Good morning, Gemma.
Good morning.
Okay, back to Gross.
Okay, and good morning, Gemma. Right. Now we're going to go on to the third utility, and that is going to be NetStat. The question it answers is, what are my active network connections, and which TCP/UDP ports are in use? To use this command, you're going to type just NetStat into your command prompt. This can tell you if there are ports open that shouldn't be, if there's spyware that's trying to through your computer and use ports, you're going to be able to see it. And I learned this week that if you type in netstat-B That would be net space, sorry, netstat space dash space capital B, you'll actually be able to see which applications are using which ports, so you'll know the nasty piece of spyware you're trying to track down.
No space between the dash and the capital B, but that's okay, and I'll just type the command into chat.
Oh, just a clarification, that's been B for Bravo?
Yep.
Alrighty.
Otherwise, you can use your arrow keys and spell it out of the chat, and then hit double tap numpad 5, double tap numpad 2 to get the phonetic of that letter as well.
Yeah, I haven't checked that. Yeah, sure.
And it's double tap numpad 5. I've just checked that.
Yep, that's right. That's what it is. If you've got a regular numpad.
Otherwise, it's double tap FNI if your numpad layout is standard.
Oh, all right. The fourth utility we're going to discuss is Traceroute. The question it answers is, what route will my packet take to another host, and how much delay will there be at each hop? To use this command, you're going to type T-R-A-C-E-R-T space, and then the web host or IP address of the host you want to trace the route to. This can tell you where a packet may be slowing down in transmission. So you're going to see if there's a bottleneck, if it's on your side, or if it's somewhere between your ISP and the actual recipient. So you'll be able to tell whose network's slowing down. So by default, Traceroute only traces 30 hops. To change this number, type T-R-A-C-E-R-T dash H, the number of desired hops, and then the host IP or website. Okay, the last tool we're going to talk about is NSLookup. The question it answers is, what is the IP address of whatever host name I type in? So to use this, you're going to type in NSLookup space, and then any host name you want to check out. So any questions on any of those five tools?
I'm just going to add a comment again. NSLookup is also an interactive utility, and it has all sorts of commands inside it. If you type NSLookup and hit enter, you can actually type in various things. You can actually query more than A records. You can query CNAME records, name server records, all those sorts of things out of the DNS. So it's a very powerful bit of kit, and it's very handy. I think it's been deprecated under the Unix operating systems in BIN 9. They're sort of encouraging you to use host instead of NSLookup. So you might actually get a warning if you fire up NSLookup under a modern Unix, and it will tell you that you really should be using host. However, I think Windows has still got NSLookup in it. I haven't actually checked under Windows Server 2008 to see if you get those obsoleted warnings or not.
Vista still has NSLookup, so I think that Windows is still probably keeping it.
Yep, fair enough.
Okay. Obviously, problems can occur on wired, wireless, and mixed networks. The easiest way to see which portion of your networks are affected by a problem is to ping the default gateway using a wired computer, then ping it again using a wireless device, then ping a wired device on your network from a wireless device, or vice versa, to verify local connectivity. If one works and the other doesn't, only the one that doesn't work has the problem. So if your wired one works to ping over into your default gateway but the wireless doesn't, it's probably a problem between your computer and the access point. If they both don't work, go ahead.
I was just going to say that be careful if you're trying that trick on a machine that both has a wireless and a wired connection. Often it is actually the wireless connection that gets preference over the wired connection. I'm not quite sure why. And if you want to know why all of your internet is going slow, perhaps you are using the wireless as opposed to your wired connection. When I say slow, I mean relatively speaking. We could be talking 54 megabits as opposed to a gigabit. So make sure that you disable the connections that you're not actually using to make sure that you are using the connection you think you are. That was all I was going to say there.
If they both don't work, it's your modem or router probably. So Or if you can't, yeah, it's your router or modem. If both of them work, it may be a router configuration problem or your ISP's network may be down. If the local connectivity test fails, check to see if your computers are actually configured properly, then check the router's configuration. Okay, so now we're going to quickly go over LEDs unless someone has questions or comments. On.
Anybody tell me what a 169.254 address means?
A PIPA.
Yeah, more specifically?
Well, it means you're not connected to DHCP server.
That's correct. The DHCP server is unreachable. So if you have an IP address of 169.254.2 randomly selected octets, you are using a PIPA, Automatic Private IP address, which is the one
that allocation.
Allocation. Actually, it might be allocation. You could be right. Automatic Private IP Address Allocation. And apparently it is used when you cannot reach the DHCP server. I found out there's actually an APIPA client for Linux the other day. Avahi has got an APIPA client built into it. Yeah, Avahi is the thing that implements all of the plug-and-play networky configuration stuff. ZeroConf and Bonjour is the Mac protocol for it. They've re-implemented an open version of Bonjour, which is the one that lets you detect iTunes and iPods and Macs and things on your network. And a lot of home media players use Bonjour to detect network resources and network music stores. The only reason I know about it is because we've got MPD running on one of our little Fit PCs and it installs a whole stack of Avahi libraries, and it does actually register itself up on the network apparently, so that other computers that run ZeroConf and stuff can find it. And in fact, if you install iTunes under Windows, which I personally don't, you will actually end up with a Bonjour client on your Windows box.
Okay, well, now we're going to talk about LEDs. Please remember that LEDs can fail, but this is rarely, rarely the case. So, we have three types of LEDs that are commonly found on devices. Those are power, status, and activity, and on a wireless access point, you may have a security one. Inactive LEDs may be an indication of device failure, port failure, or cabling issues. It is possible that the device is non-functional due to faulty hardware. The port itself might also have become faulty due to hardware or improper configuration. regardless of whether the network is wired or wireless, verify the device and ports are up and functional before spending a large amount of time on trying to troubleshoot other issues. Lights on modems and routers do vary from manufacturer to manufacturer, so do please check your manual. But the things I'm going to tell you are usually true, so you can probably bank on them, but I really do check the manual and make sure that for the device you know exactly what the LEDs mean, because they could mean something totally different. The security LED indicates the current condition of security settings on the device. Solid green indicates security is enabled. Activity LEDs, wireless internet or Ethernet, are sometimes referred to as link lights. They are normally associated with a specific port, so they're going to be right over your RJ45 connectors, or the wireless, I believe, is just all one. The normal condition is to flash, indicating that traffic is flowing through the port. On some of the devices, the rate of flash indicates the speed that the port is operating at. Solid green indicates that a device is plugged into the port, but no traffic is flowing. Flashing green, of course, indicates that the device is plugged in and receiving traffic. Amber indicates the device is making adjustments to the way the port is working, so this means it's not quite working as expected. No light indicates that nothing is plugged into the port or that there is an issue with the wired or wireless connection. Remember that the exact meanings of colors may vary according to the equipment manufacturer. Again, check the manual. The power LED is usually a solid green color, and it indicates power to the device, obviously. So no light indicates a problem with the power. Check the power connections. All right. Any questions on LEDs?
What does LED stand for?
You evil person. Do you know what LED stands
for? That is not fair.
You know, Chris.
I'm just saying if Chris knows.
Do you?
Now I do. Someone just typed it into chat, but I didn't.
That is cheating. All right, now for extra credit, what's a diode?
You're evil.
Oh, yes, you are. It's a little thing that is very, very small, and electricity flows
correct
through it, and it lights up or whatever.
Actually, you're almost... they are usually small. A diode is a semiconductor device that allows electricity to flow in one direction only. They are usually made of silicon or germanium, and you use different diodes for different applications. For example, you use germanium diodes in silicon radios. And a light-emitting diode is exactly that. It is when the electricity travels through it in the right direction, photons are emitted. And when electricity flows through in the wrong direction, it goes, and there's actually a whole pile of smoke.
So that's what'll happen. That's the problem when you see the or smell the router going up in smoke. One of the diodes probably just blew out, or many of them did. All right, thank you.
I was just going to point out also that if you have a router and you suddenly manage to lose its power supply, which is something that people do, you have to be very careful that when you are, because you, of course, will, as a responsible user, go down and buy the exact correct power supply from the manufacturer. If you are perhaps trying to cut corners and find a replacement power supply, make sure that you have the correct voltage, AC or DC, and the correct polarity, or your router will go bang and then you will have no router. I would strongly recommend getting a replacement supply from the manufacturer unless you know exactly what you are doing. So be aware of that.
Is that like when somebody sells you a NAS box and then sends you the wrong power adapter?
That'd be the one. And then you end up plugging the power adapter in that they sent you in good faith to find out that not only was the power adapter underrated for the NAS box, but that it had the 5 and 12 volt lines wired up differently. This is a digression, but you know how you get those power adapters for external hard disk boxes that have sort of got that 5-pin DIN on the end of them? Anybody seen those?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh yeah, I have one of those.
There is no standard for how those 5 pins are wired up. So if you put the wrong adapter into the wrong hard disk box, you could quite possibly bang the box or the hard drive or both.
Oh, I've got a great story. When I was in about third grade, I took my, I think it was my Braille and Speaks adapter and plugged it into my tape player, and I got the battery to go smoke and pretty much not work ever.
Ah, tape recorder. When you say the tape recorder, do you mean one of those GE model 1542-whatever they were, the big, heavy brown ones, or was this a different sort of tape recorder?
Oh no, this was a handy cassette, too.
Oh, nice and expensive. Oh, okay.
The little ones.
Is anybody else being curious and just flip that voltage selection switch to see what it does?
We've all done it, but we usually do it on devices we don't care about, because if you overvolt something, it will die. Although, interestingly enough, you can run a double torque on 6 volts. It will sort of run, and provided you don't turn its volume up too high, it will actually cope, interestingly enough.
I did it on my dad's stereo when I was about 8. Never told him.
Did you kill it?
Oh, yeah.
I'll have to make a mental note to tell him next time I'm over.
It was nice knowing you, Chris. I just have to find my place here.
Anybody got any comments or things they'd like to add while Grace is scrolling?
Hopefully that silence is golden. All right.
Yeah, it is.
I've got my place. All right. Now we're going to go over some common connectivity issues. If a wired client is unable to connect, the very first thing to do is check what?
That's a question, people. If a wired client cannot connect, what is the first thing you should check?
Layer one.
Physical connection.
Yes, the cables. A battered disconnected cable is the most common reason a wired device experiences connectivity problems. So make sure you're using the correct type of cable for computer to computer. Use a crossover cable for connecting a switch or a router to a device. Make sure to use a straight through cable. That too. Make sure your cables do not exceed the maximum distance requirement. For Cat 5 or Cat 5e cables, this is 100 meters or somewhere around 300. Make sure the correct ports are being used to connect to your two devices. You won't get internet if a PC is plugged into your uplink port. I've done this, I know. Don't run your cables where they are in danger of being stepped on, rolled over, or otherwise damaged by rabbits or cats. Otherwise, if you think you have a bad cable and you have another one that you know works, switch it out and see if it's the cable, because it's very difficult for us to be able to tell if there's a problem on the inside of the cable, whether it's badly crimped or it wasn't wired right. It's just very hard to tell, so just switch it out and see if it works. That's the good blindy way.
You can also get, if you are sighted and you do have an LED or a light probe that will read LEDs, you can actually get cheap cable testers from your local electronics store, such as Tandy, Dick Smith's, Radio Shack, whatever, that will at least do wire map, and that will tell you whether all of the pins are connected properly. Obviously, they won't do any of the more complex tests, such as saturation, link speed, bit speed, all that sort of stuff. You'd have to get a much more expensive cable tester for that.
You know how some of the motherboards have that on the onboard Ethernet? Is there a Windows utility for that, or do you have to look at it in the BIOS?
There is a Windows utility, and I don't know whether it's accessible, but I have a feeling that Vista box, although you probably can't run the utility under Vista, has AINet too. So it might be worth having a look. That's the one that'll tell you whether your pairs are good and whether your cable is gigabit rated. It's actually part of the Marvell transceiver specification to have those diagnostics actually built into the network card's transceiver, so it can do a number of those tests.
Yeah, I think there is that utility for Vista. I think I downloaded it when we were fixing Geraldine's. I'd have to have a look.
Ian leaving, he has to go to a meeting. I'm sure he'd rather stay and listen to your lecture.
Just thought I'd ask. Okay. I was like, that bad, is it?
No, you're doing well. You're doing exceedingly well, in fact.
I think so.
All right. Well, then I will continue and we'll go on to wireless devices. So if a wireless device is unable to connect to an access point, there are probably wireless connectivity issues. What would be your first clue, guys? Wireless connections use radio frequency signals to connect, so there are quite a few factors that can affect the ability to connect. There are several wireless standards, and not all of the standards are compatible. For example, a device that runs on an A standard may not be compatible with a B standard because they're on different frequencies. I think one is on 2.4 and the other's on 5-something, so they're quite different and they don't work together unless you run a really mixed mode crazy thing. And a really, really good router. So make sure your wireless device and routers are working on the same standard. If not, many routers allow you to change which standard or standards they're using. For example, some PDAs run on only B, so you have to change your router to accept B and G. Any questions on that?
I was actually going to say beware of G-only devices, and they are out there. There are actually some wireless cards that are seriously G-only. I saw some in some Acer laptops, and they don't support fallback to B. It's not as much of a problem these days, although it is becoming a bit of a problem, especially with B, G, and N devices that have fallback. I think Grace pointed to an issue where if she had N enabled on one of her routers, the BrailleSense Plus wouldn't work with it, but it would if you had BG. I think that was what you said.
That's exact. That was right. And it was a TrendNet, but this Linksys one is really cool because you can have a separate BG network and a separate AN network. So I just kill A, and I've got an N network that only my computers can connect to because nobody else has N. So I've got my own little network signal segment, and it's pretty cool.
And the reason you can do that is because there are actually two access points in the Linksys, and it actually has two different sorts of antennas. The BG antennas are the long, thin ones, and the N antenna is the flat one. If yours has flat antennas, I'm not sure if all of them do. We've got some WRT.
And mine does not.
Okay, we've got some WRT 300Ns here, and they've got a flat aerial and two round ones.
Well, mine, you can have the 2.4 GHCN as well. I just disabled that because nobody's using it anyway, and I just connected the portion. Oh my goodness, my sensitivity is really...
Okay, anybody else got any comments or things they want to add at this point?
I'm disappearing again.
Okay, make sure you get the bus.
I will see people later in the association.
No worries.
Have fun. Have a good day.
Thanks, Grace.
Okay, so... each wireless conversation must be on a separate non-overlapping channel, and I guess that means 4 apart, is that right?
Yep, 1, 5, and 11. Although I think you guys are only allowed to use 1 through 10. We're allowed to theoretically use 1 through 13, although, and this is illegal, so I would recommend that you not do it. I usually go through my router and find out which country setting is going to give me channels 1 through 14 and use that. Although, we did have a case where Gemma's Intel card on her, Toshiba Tekra, would only recommend things, would only see things on channels 1 through 11 because it was set to US country code rules. And I had one of my access points up on channel 14 and she couldn't see it. So, yeah, probably worth being aware of those sorts of things. There are ways of changing the regulatory domain of your wireless card in certain circumstances, but sometimes you are stuck with the card that is embedded in your laptop, so that can limit the channels you can use.
I didn't know there were different... channels though, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a minefield. In fact, in Japan, you're only allowed to use channel 14.
How do you have more than one access point?
Sorry, Elise?
You mean so the whole country just uses one channel?
Well, legally, yeah. If you set it to Japanese, normally you can only get to channel 14. Was it the Japanese or Israel? I can't remember which one it was.
Good grief, especially countries with those populations. I'll let you answer Grace's questions because I think it's a very good one.
Grace's question was, how do you have multiple access points? Mm. You can have multiple access points on one channel. It just degrades wireless performance. That's why the wireless uses spread spectrum. The channels are actually, the bandwidth on the channel is about 10 megahertz wide, and it actually modifies the frequency. It actually spreads the signal across the frequency band, and it is actually possible to have two different SSIDs running on the same channel with a degradation in performance as a result.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all really interesting about that. So, right on. Okay. Some devices can be configured...
In the diagrams, I've seen a lot of stuff like about the packet tracer. So is it really very inaccessible, or is it possible to do a bit of things?
How many times do I have to tell you, Pratrip? It's completely inaccessible. Packet tracer is inaccessible.
Okay, but most of that stuff you can just do on your computer regularly, like all the ping stuff and IP config. If you just look at the help files in there and go and mess around with it, that's probably going to do you a whole lot more good than the packet tracer stuff would have anyway.
Yeah, the advantage of packet tracer.
Yeah, the command line.
There is no
to play with the packet tracer if it works.
No, well you can't. No.
I think we're, I haven't tried that though.
Yeah, no, we're working on accessibility for Packet Tracer, and in fact in version 5 we should see some accessibility features go in. We do have a student who has succeeded in getting an SSH command line to talk to Packet Tracer through the API, but at the moment Packet Tracer is considered completely inaccessible. The advantage of Packet Tracer, which is why they push it so hard, is that you can actually prototype a network. You can go, I want 6 workstations, 3 routers and a partridge in a pear tree, and you can actually then prototype your network up and draw the connections up and stuff like that and set the subnets and things like that. So it is a very powerful learning tool, and you can actually run simulations inside it, but we still have work ongoing to make Packet Tracer work, and we will be converting the Packet Tracer labs back into regular labs, so don't think you'll all get out of them. We're going to redo them all so that you have to do them, so that's something to look forward to. Maybe not for this group, maybe for the next group, but yeah, we will be making sure that you all get to do an alternate version of the Packet Tracer labs.
A lot of the Packet Tracer labs, though, kind of look like duplicates of the regular labs, so...
Yeah, they're trying to get you familiar with doing Packet Tracer before you get into Discovery 2, where we tend to see a bit more Packet Tracer activity. It is basically for academies who can't afford the amount of equipment that would be required to actually build these networks up in real hardware, and for people who can't afford those sorts of things. That said, however, you can actually boot up 2 or 3 virtual machines on a physical machine and use 2 or 3 virtual machines networked over the virtual switch to simulate some of that Packet Tracer stuff if you really feel that you don't have the actual hardware to do it and you do have plenty of RAM in your computer.
Shall we continue?
Yep.
Alright. Some APs can be configured to select the least congested or highest throughput channel. Although automatic settings work, manual setting of the AP channel provides greater control and may be necessary in some environments. If you have a bunch of access points, it's probably a good idea. The farther a device is away from an access point, the weaker the signal is to that device.
Sorry, Grace. Your voice is breaking a lot.
It's your end, Prateep. Sorry, she's coming in 5x5 here. Yeah, Indian internet again.
Sorry about that.
You'll be able to get the recording. Yep, go ahead, Grace.
Okay. So as I was saying, if the device is too far away from the access point, the connection will become unreliable and drop completely. Outside interference can...
Who?
Sorry, Geraldine can tell you all about that.
Oh, yes. Geraldine's got wireless access point up one end of her house, and her computer's all the way down the other with all these walls and stuff in the way. And we actually had to set up a repeater in the middle. We got an Ultra WAP and configured it in repeater mode. And that was how we managed to get the signal to travel around all those distances, because she just couldn't quite get a reliable connection. And that's something to be aware of. If you have people who do have wireless access points and you've got, say, upstairs and downstairs, generally the signal is thrown out in a donut shape from your standard... standard antenna, which is horizontal polarization, which is to say you don't get a lot of signal to the floor above and you don't get a lot of signal to the floor below if you have a floor above and below. So often you need an access point per level of the house. You don't actually get a full spherical cover of signal. So be aware of that. Although if you do have good access points, we actually do have our upstairs neighbour who's in the unit up and across from us sharing our internet access. But we perhaps have a little more experience in setting up wireless access points than your average I just bought a wireless access point from large department store style person.
I've got a story about that. My dad had a network set up and he cleverly got the patch panel installed down in his basement. So before I came here, we had the wireless access point in the basement, and this place is 3 floors. So it was quite hard to get a signal. So what I had done was get a switch and plug everything from the patch panel into the switch, and then I went up to one of the hardwire ports up on the second floor and plugged in this nice Linksys N router I got so that everybody could actually use the internet on all floors of the house. So now it's pretty nice, but it really wasn't before.
And that's one of the many skills that Discovery One will give you, the ability to adequately plan a network for all of your home networking needs. End advertisement. Okay, let's continue.
All right. Outside interference can cause noise on a wireless connection. If there's too much noise, the connection may become unstable. Well, yes. The more devices that connect to a wireless access point, the less bandwidth each device gets. Eventually, too many devices on one access point will slow the network to a crawl.
I left it a bit long there to interject. Most home access points actually have an association limit of 31 devices, just so that you know.
Wow, I didn't really think it was that high. Okay. Okay, so those are our connectivity problems with the wireless. The other main category of problems with wireless access points is configuration issues. Incorrect configuration with security settings will stop a client from connecting to the wireless access point. Also, some devices are not compatible with higher level security methods. For example, the Braille node is not compatible with WPA2, so you'll have to use WAP or WPA to connect your Braille node up to router. Before you implement a security method, make sure all of the devices you want to connect to the access point work with that particular method. I have messed this up before and put in a WPA2 for all of my devices, and the Braille node doesn't connect, so I've got to go through and configure all of my other devices again and make a different security method so that my Braille node can connect. I don't have a Braille note anymore. I learned my lesson. All right. Make sure the SSID matches on the client and the access point if your SSID is hidden and you have to manually enter it. Now, if the SSID is broadcast, this isn't an issue because it's going to automatically be done for you. If security is enabled, which it should be, make sure the client has the correct key. If it doesn't, it's not going to connect because it won't be able to authenticate at all. So that's it on the wireless problems for now. If there are any questions, go ahead.
Another gotcha. Some access points will allow you to put in a password to generate the WEP keys. Now with WEP, there is multiple methods of generating the key from the password, and the only portable way to put in WEP keys is to actually put in one of the hex keys, not the actual password, into your client devices. WPA and WPA2 have also standardized the method of putting in the passphrase. Sorry, Mark and his clicking mouse was putting me off there for a minute. I want a silent click mouse. I wonder if they make them.
Wouldn't those optical mouses be a little bit quieter?
No. That's all right. I'm focused now. So he's yeah. It's in a quiet lecture theatre. You tend to be able to hear these clicking mice, and they sort of bounce around and do 20 other things in the middle of lecture. So we get a lot of mouse activity. We don't actually we're not quite as harsh on them as we were at TAFE. We used to actually make everybody turn their computers off, but we're not quite that mean. And we can't do that, otherwise you wouldn't be on Ventrilo.
Exactly. Okay, so now we're going to go on to not connection-related problems. We're connecting fine, and we know that. So now we're going to go up. So if the physical connection to the wired or wireless host appears to be connecting as expected, then check the IP configuration of the client. Go to your wireless router status page and make sure you're actually connected to your ISP. If you see an IP address of 0.0.0.0 or no IP address at all, you're not connected or you have a serious DHCP problem. Release and renew your IP address on the router if possible, if that's the case. If you're unable to do this, do what I do. Go downstairs, take a pen, reset the router. I have a router that actually does not have a release and renew or a reboot button on it, so you actually have to go down there and reset it. It's pretty sad. If you do have an IP address from your ISP, open a command prompt and type in ipconfig space slash all and make sure that the settings such as the default gateway and DNS servers match. Also make sure you're on the same LAN segment as your default gateway on your router. If you're not, release and renew the IP address from the command prompt as discussed earlier. If that doesn't work, you may have to reconfigure your router and or computer to use the correct default gateway. I had this problem. I had two DHCP servers running and didn't quite realize that you're not supposed to do that. So half the time I was able to get on the internet and had a good IP address, and half the time I wasn't. And so I had to go troubleshoot that, and I ended up turning off the DHCP server on the upstairs router and left the one on the one in the basement on, so that I only had one DHCP server and it was the one closest to the cable modem. Okay, so now if the computer on the network can connect to each other but not the internet, it's probably a problem between your router and the ISP. As I said before, go to the router status page and make sure the connection is active. If it isn't and you're not able to establish connectivity, contact the ISP to nicely report the problem. We're going to go back to some network documentation now. It is an important part of any troubleshooting process. Network documentation should include a normal baseline measurement of network performance against which potential problems can be judged. What I do is find a super fast website with a big file on it, like freedomscientific.com. I'll just go download JAWS and see how fast I can get it to go. And that is part of my baseline performance. The performance baseline can include the types of traffic normally expected, as well as the volume of traffic to and from servers and network devices. The baseline should be documented just after the network is installed when it is running optimally. Baseline performance should be reestablished after any major changes to the network are implemented, because if you change it, your baseline might change and you need to know what the new norm is. When troubleshooting, remember to keep good documentation. We went over this, but as a reminder, good documentation should include the initial problem, steps taken to isolate the problem, results of all steps taken, both successful and unsuccessful, final determined cause of the problem, final problem resolution, and preventative measures, because you don't want the problem to happen again. This will help you in your future troubleshooting endeavors, because now you're going to have a bunch of documentation to look at if a problem exactly like or similar to the problem that you've just fixed ever occurs again. If you can't figure out a resolution... go ahead.
I was just going to say, Chris, didn't you fix a problem with a network at one point where they had two routers or something, and every time they had the two routers turned on or something, you would actually get a repeat of the problem that they were seeing beforehand? Is Chris still logged in? Oh, yeah, he is. He's probably just gone to sleep.
Sorry, I was just in the kitchen and had my name. What was the question?
Didn't you have a problem where they had two routers on the one network and you fixed a thing for your real estate agent, and they kept getting this problem where if you had two routers up or something, PCs would get the wrong IP address or something? You had to rejig the network or something? I think you were telling a story about it a week or two.
They had a modem router, and they'd also added on a wireless router to give them wireless throughout the office, but the technician who had installed it hadn't set it up properly. He just pretty much plugged it in, so they had two DHCP servers, one on each router. So that was causing a lot of conflicts between the systems, as they all had different IP addresses and some were getting one from a different range, and so they weren't talking to each other very well. And then whenever they had to turn off the computers and turn them back on again, all the IP addresses would screw up and they'd have to reset pretty much every application to use the new IP addresses, because the original technician hadn't even set the server as a static IP.
Oh, that's what I did to myself. You had the exact same problem I did.
So basically he was charging them $50 an hour every time he'd come out and fix it up, and that would happen every time that the routers had to be reset or if there was a power outage. So I charged them $60 an hour to fix it up, and I've never had to go back to solve that problem again.
Now you have to ask if the technician is very clever.
What an upstanding technician.
Yeah, there's lots of shoddiness out there, as we call them, bush technicians, that don't actually resolve the problems completely and then charge the client for the privilege of going out and fixing them every time the problems reoccur, knowing full well that they'd reoccur. I remember there was a rort a couple, well, it was quite a number of years back, because I don't think that the trick would work these days, because most people set them to auto-detect. But what people used to do was they'd sell off somebody a 300 meg hard drive. This was back in the meg days. They'd sell somebody a 300 meg hard drive, and they'd actually install an 850 meg hard drive in the machine, and then about 2 months later, the person would want a hard disk update, so they'd charge them for the hardware upgrade and just change the CMOS setting so they'd have 540 meg, and then they'd ask for another hard drive upgrade, so they'd change it to, say, 600 meg, and then they'd just keep increasing the hard disk settings, changing the CMOS settings and expanding the partition, and absolutely make a small fortune from all of these hard disk upgrades that never actually happened because the machine already had an 850 meg hard drive in it.
Well, I wish I'd clients that were that predictable.
Wow, that is horrible. And you probably could make the clients predictable if you sold them these new hard drives and got them all into them, you know. Oh, yeah, this hard drive's so much bigger. So, yeah, that I could see where that'd work. That's horrible, though.
Yeah, no one likes the bush technicians anyway, but if you get a decent backyard technician like me or a garage technician, what I do is, if there's a problem, I find out what's causing it rather than just doing the quick fix and charging them. I find what the cause is and I fix it, and hopefully it doesn't happen again. And that's the trick to keeping customers anyway.
It is. Solve their problems and make sure the customer is happy. Okay, it's back to Grace, I think, for the next bit of her lecture. I think we're getting there.
I think we might be able to get this all done, actually. So, yeah. All right, next we're going to talk about when you cannot figure out a problem on your own, which happens. Everybody does it. Not everybody is perfect. Well, nobody's perfect. We don't know the answer to every problem. So,
we call Kerry. Just kidding.
He's not perfect either. So,
I'm not. But I do sometimes get calls from my fellow classmates at unusual hours on Skype or MSN requests or emails with problems that they haven't been able to diagnose themselves. And that's just their method of personal networking. We've had a few people drop off Ventrilo. Who have we lost?
It was Pratik and Rohit, I believe it was.
Ah, okay. Their internet connections just dropped out, obviously.
For me, yeah, I get those kind of calls too. But nobody's perfect, and you're really mad at somebody if they don't know the answer to your problem, or expect them to drop everything and help you with their problem.
Yes, believe it or not, people work on the other end of the help desk. We haven't found a way of employing the Borg to do it yet, so you are actually talking to a person on the other end of the help desk.
So here are some coping strategies if you cannot figure out a resolution to a problem on your own. It is perfectly acceptable to research the solution. You can go... Oh my goodness, this thing is not liking me. You can go to a manufacturer's website and look at manuals or FAQs. If that doesn't have the answer, you can try a search engine. Google's your friend. I use Google all the time. I've found that when I type in the proper search terms, there's usually a helpful article, blog post, or user forum to give me ideas. And it's a lot faster than trying to find someone online that might know the answer to my problem, and it bugs them a lot less. So Google's really awesome. If you really get stuck, ask a coworker or a friend. Use that personal network of yours. They may have had experiences with the problem before and some ideas on how to fix it, but they may not, and that's okay too. The other thing that is valuable is the documentation that you've kept over the years. When you're stuck, it's a good time to look back through it, and you might find an idea you'd forgotten about, and that documentation will jog your memory, and you'd be like, oh, yeah, now I know how to fix it.
It's also worth mentioning that if you do research your own problems and you find yourself independently able to research your own problems and the solutions to your own problems, it will make you a far more employable IT person. Nobody wants somebody in the office that has to go and ask somebody all the time. So this is a big hint to what we've done a number of Thursday chats on researching in Google. I'd encourage anybody who has weak research skills or thinks they might have weak research skills to find those Thursday chats on the QCAT website and listen to them because they have some very important information. And as we continue through the courses, I will be expecting a lot more independent research. We will not be spoon-feeding you everything. There will be things you will have to go and look up, as I'm sure people have already discovered if they've been through ITE 1 and done all of those worksheets looking up specs on laptops and stuff, so be warned.
Final bit, we have one final little bit of this, and that is talking about help desks and calling them. Two quick things on that. Be organized when you call the help desk. Actually, it's a really good idea to kind of know what the problem is if you can. Be in front of your computer or device that isn't working, because you can't fix it if you're not. Don't call from the car. That's just not good. Also, remember that the help desk technicians are humans, and if there's a network problem or something, it's probably not their fault, and don't abuse them. So I think that's about it. Any questions or comments?
How about we hit stop?